Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the recurrent accidental military airstrikes in Nigeria. I'm joined by very special guest, Dr. Ndubuisi Nwokolo. Dr. Nwokolo is a partner and chief executive at Nestia Security, Peace and Development, an international development consulting firm based in Nigeria's capital city, Abuja. He is currently a senior visiting scholar at the Center for Intelligence, Security and Peace Studies, Cole University, Enugu State, Nigeria. He also holds other positions, including as a visiting research fellow, York University, Ontario, Canada, and as a non-residential fellow at the School of Government and Society, University of Birmingham. Ndubuisi, it's a great pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Michael.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So we've seen in the last couple of years, at least nearly 10 years now, since the Nigerian government has been battling the Boko Haram insurgency and now maybe the bandits in the northwest of Nigeria. We've seen several quote-unquote accidental mishaps. What is behind these frequent mishaps in your opinion?
I mean, there could be a couple of things, you know, but if you look at it more from a technical perspective as well as more from a general perspective now, insecurity is on the increase. Various forms of criminality is on the increase. The police is unable to cope. The military are being brought in. And then Nigeria is in a new terrain of security management. This hasn't been one of the things we've experienced in the time past. So we're experiencing it. So the military, who may not understand most of these very difficult terrain, are responding to the way they know. I mean, in most countries, these are some of the issues the police could easily take care of. But now we have the police who are either inadequate or do not have the capacity to do so. So you're bringing military. And then military are using what they know best, which is to kill and occupy. And again, you have a situation where ab initio, Nigeria as a colonial state was built in a manner where the people and the state, or in this state, or rather, let me be more direct now, the people and the security architecture or security institutions were not really five and six here, I mean very close, as in fine in other state. Because people have always seen either the police or the military as an occupational force. So even where most of the things are happening, the tendency that you see them work together is one of the new things we are doing. So, I mean, there are a couple of things to discuss here. Both failure of intelligence, both failure of collaboration and stakeholder engagement, and so on and so forth. I mean, there are a lot.
Very, very interesting. We You mentioned a lot of things that we could pick up. You mentioned the failure of intelligence and civil-military relations, and you also mentioned the police. Whereas most of these things can. But let me start from the point of. Let me ask a more direct question. So we know in history we've seen through the world wars and even other kind of like we've seen friendly fires. You know, the United States have shot at that. So we can say it is not without antecedent. That you know, it's possible for people to, but with such frequency in the Nigerian case, could we say this is avoidable? Some of these attacks, could there be element of some sort of mischief?
Let me start by saying, are they avoidable? Yes. Would avoidance be 100%? No, because stuff like this may likely happen, you know. I mean, collateral damage are acceptable in wars, right? Mm-hmm. But the frequency might be what we're looking at. I mean, between 2014 and 2024, we've had about 18 of them. And mm-hmm. Those 18, we're looking at probably above 150 recorded deaths, right? Once they accepted and once they denied. And when each time it happens, there will first be a denial before an acceptance, right? This hasn't really built that relationship between the society and the security agencies, right? In extension and the state. Now, just as late as 3 months ago, similar thing happened in Zamfara State as well. And as well, we could remember the one that happened late December in Sokoto or somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, if you put all these things in proper perspective, the issue remains that the gap between the people and these institutions have always existed. So when you now say, could this thing have been avoided? To do this is to even step back and look at the nature and character of the Nigerian state, or even the nature of character of the African state, how it has been constituted as a state. Then you step it down to the making of a state building. Can the military be better than the state, than all the functions and activities of the state? No. I mean, they are all one and the same, right? So if the state is an ineffective state, has not really functioned very well in all aspects of its role, how do you think it would suddenly become so excellent in doing this? So the failure you're seeing is not different from the failure of the Nigerian state. Just that this, because of is the heat of the moment, we're discussing it. To me, I see the failure to actually execute those things the way it should be, right? When you want to carry out those military operations and you fail, thereby having this constant military or friendly fires. I mean, that's what we're using now, right? I see it as almost the same thing as a failure to provide good roads, electricity, and so on and so forth. So they are just the same thing. Just that this has more to do with security. I mean, that's the better way to describe it. So what we're saying is that the failure of the military to carry out those systematic, tactical, and operational activities is the same as the failure of the state from all its ramifications to do all the roles a state should do.
Speaking of the state and its failures, in situations like this, the state usually have an oversight over the stuff. So in cases where this has happened, what has the Nigerian state or who are those? Let's first start off. Who are those responsible for providing oversight, things like this?
First you start from. Now, because these are counter-insurgencies, in sane community, sane society, where things are done very well, counterinsurgencies are led by the government, which is an institution of the state. They are not led by the military, which is another institution of the state. You know, the mistake we make is that each time we forget to differentiate institutions of the state and what they should be doing. Because institutions of the state have different roles that the state may have given to them. It is always important to make sure that each institution of the state knows what they are supposed to be doing. So, for an instance, if you have the government leading counterinsurgencies, right? Mm. It means that they coordinate it, especially maybe with the Office of the National Security Advisor. Then it becomes easier when things like this are happening, because this has a lot to do with winning the mind and hearts of the people, right? Oversighting is easier. Coordination is easier. When you get such intelligence, you can use other non-formal structures to do the coordination and to do the oversight. So oversight now from activities of the military, as well as coordinating with the local communities on what to do at a certain time, including, do we need to move them out? Do we need intelligence to tell them, don't allow them to use it as human shield? But the government should be at the forefront of this overall oversight and coordination. Now, there could be other forms of coordination, like the military, who oversights the military, which should come from the Ministry of Defense. Of course, Ministry of Defense is part of the government, right? Then, I mean, these are the way these things are done. But a situation where the military almost is the one now leading the entire counterinsurgencies, are the one even moving it forward, making statements, giving out communication on their own. You do not see this government, which should be at the forefront of what the state wants. These are very difficult. So, I mean, that's what we're experiencing in the country.
I agree with 100%, because again, I'll look at these and give a bit of some context. When we looked at in 2000 and the beginning of the fight against Boko Haram, in my own research, you look at the first joint task force in 2010, 2011, where you had some symmetry between the different arms, and you know, the police, the military, the air force, and all of that. And then when President Jonathan came with the state of emergency in 2013, and then they disbanded all of that joint task force, and had the military was now unanimously in charge of countries. That's where you had other human rights violations. But then again, you mentioned the Office of the National Security Advice as well. That also was being led by the military, where the military had, you know, sole power. Because I think I was involved in one of the, where I was opportunity to go to the one of the prison to interview some Boko Haram suspects, and the military was virtually in charge of the whole stuff. Now, but moving forward, in recent times, we've kind of seen in the Buhari's administration till now, we've seen some kind of interagency collaboration, because then there was more some kind of interagency rivalry where the Air Force, Nigerian Air Force, might not be giving information, intelligence to the military, and there was no coordination. But we've seen all of that. But yet, we are still seeing this kind of stuff. What do you think is happening? Because we've seen people have talked about sabotage, people have talked about corruption, people have talked about a whole lot of this dimension to it. Do you think it's all of this?
Yeah, it's all of this. It's all of this. I mean, the gulf in the interagency collaboration and cooperation has really reduced, yeah, from what it was during the early part of President Buhari. when the military and the between the military, that's here, I'm talking about the Army and the Air Force, nearly didn't see eye to eye. The Army wanted to have their own fighter jets and all that. I mean, it was really something that you say is absorbed in some quarters, you know. And then there were some close up ranks trying to get things sorted out. To what we have today with President Tinubu, where the three heads of the three armed forces, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, are from the same course. They're all course 39, right? So which has made things a bit easier in trying to make them work a bit seamlessly. But beyond all that is, you know, each time we hear, like the Office of National Security Advisor, even before President Tinubu appointed Rebado, I was one of the voices that kept saying that our National Security Advisor must not be somebody with military background. I mean, if they look at opinions of people, I spoke in so many forum in Abuja, rather. So many fora, so many discussion groups, you know. I'm even saying we should do more. Why can't I be the National Security Advisor? Why can't I be a professor of statistics, a professor of international relations, peace, security, and whatever? Why must it be somebody who is a policeman or that, right? I have always said that. Because most time that office is not about how military serve you are, right? It's about coordination, right? It's about deep thinking. It's about trying to turn research to policy and move forward, right? So what we saw is that within this time, why we are having most of these things, friendly fires and so on, it's because some of my thinking is because the operation ab initio have always not taken into cognizance a lot of things, which is how do we buy the people over? Buy in parentheses, right? How do we win the hearts of the people? Because there are situations where the people do not even trust the ability of the state to be there for them. I mean, I'm sure you may have read this guy's book, Oliver Kaplan, where he talks about how community protect themselves. He was looking at examples from Pakistan, from Colombia, where the people will now say, if the state cannot protect us, why should we be on their side? So these are what you're saying. We're a situation where the people are saying, so why should we go report a bandit group to the military or to the police when we know the inability of the state to protect us is not there? Sorry, the ability of the state to protect us is not there, right? So at times you find out that these bandit groups equally use them as human shield. So there's a lot of complication. But those complications are the things we need to sit down to map them and start building more bridges between the state and the people, right? And now remember, this cannot just be done using military approach or kinetic approach. Some of these things could be done using other peace building platform, non-security platform, to start making the people to know that the state is there for you. So a situation where the people are all farmers, and you're coming to say they know that the bandits are in the deep forest where they farm, and you're asking them leave that particular area because we will be bombing the area. And part of the things they'll be asking you is, what happens to us when you take us away from here? I mean, it has happened in many situations where you're asking people, oh, there'll be flooding. Okay. And then you're asking the community to relocate. Yeah. And they're asking you, you may have given us early warning. So what other response are you trying to provide for us? If I move, what about my family?
Yeah.
Right? Mm. So you put all these things in perspective, it becomes easier. If I know that if I move because you want to bomb a particular bandit group, that you're going to take care of me, I will do that. If I know that if I give you that intelligence that you require for you to be able to do your work, it will not come back to hurt me, right? Because people may have given out the details of the community to the bandits. Then we will do that. I mean, these are some of the things, when you put it in perspective, you can now begin to understand. And when you talk about sabotage and so on, I mean, situation where some of these operations fail even before it happens, you find out that the bandit group have relocated and the community who didn't know what was happening is being attacked. It's equally important to understand. So that means that they are inside, information that are not, shouldn't be privy to some people, but it has been leaked, right? So those sabotage are there, right? So these are the things, when you put all of them in perspective, you can begin to understand that there is more we can do than just saying, okay, we're going to attack this community because bandits are there.
Okay. So we are talking about building trust. And one of the ways to build trust, besides, attending to governance and all of that, also is also accountability, when people who are responsible for this place are held accountable. So we talked about the oversight. You mentioned the Ministry of Defense, and there's something I'm recently reviewing, which is an interesting paper that I'm reviewing, where you're looking at the civilian oversight of the military in Nigeria. So if you look at the Ministry of Defense, and how you also mentioned how it's always been the military, a former military that are heads, and it shouldn't be, but there are other institutions as well, like the National Assembly.
Yes.
And all of that. How well are they executing their role? And in all of these incidents, how much have anybody been held accountable? Has any senior military officer been held accountable for all of these accidents? Have we seen it?
I mean, apart from the Minister of Defense, which should be the supervising government agency that should be working with the Nigerian military, the next is the National Assembly, which is another arm of government with that legislative oversight. But the question is, how knowledgeable are they? They even start from there. Situation where some people win election into the National Assembly, and probably this guy is in House Committee or Senate Committee on National Security. He's there for the next 4 years, and he doesn't come back after 4 years. But if you go to strong democracies, you could see somebody, he has been in that one committee for 20 years. He knows almost inside out. And they are privy to every detail, every information that is being done, right? But it's not same with us. So if you ask the Senate Committee chairman now on national security, the last arm that was procured in Nigeria, probably he doesn't know. Once he gets that, which is for him, right? He doesn't do any other thing. Yeah. I mean, there's this video that went viral last week about a senior civil servant in the National Assembly who, during their retreat, he shouldn't have been there, but somebody recorded it, where she was blasting members of the Senate and House of Rep to say, how can you say you're having an oversight function or you're carrying out an oversight duty when the people you're supposed to be oversighting are the ones paying your ticket, your allowances to come oversight them? What would you be doing? What would you be saying? So these are the situations. So the National Assembly is almost like is almost like not representing the people very well in terms of those oversight functions. So I can't remember. It may have happened, right? I can't remember having, unless these are done closed doors, because that's what they would tell me. I can't remember seeing any public hearing on this kind of friendly fire and collateral damage. I can't remember seeing any of the Senate Committee on Army, Police, and all the rest of them on national security calling for such such public hearing where people will come and then maybe they will use that to see how to deepen ways to start mitigating this thing. I can't remember hearing about anyone. Maybe when you ask them, they will tell you issues of such magnitude, especially in relation to national security, are not made public hearing. That's what they will tell you. but what I know for sure is that we need to start doing something around that. The reasons being that hearing going to stop very soon because we are still in deep crisis, right? The insecurity is on the increase. Would the military continue to be involved? Yes, right? So the earlier we start looking at means and ways of start reducing this, the better for us.
Yeah. I agree with you. You mentioned something early on that is in tandem with the kind of conclusions that's happening in the book. The nature of the Nigerian state, and by extension, the nature of the African state, and how in nation building, I don't think we've built. I don't think African nations, virtually other countries, are a nation in the sense of, in the functional sense of what a nation should be. Because I've seen on YouTube, even on YouTube, you see where senators or people in charge are called to the Congress to come and defend, to come, and they are questioned, and it's in the public. It's a public hearing. So I don't see why that shouldn't happen in Nigeria. But again, in Nigeria, another aspect as well is, I was watching a clip where a man in Zamfara, you mentioned Zamfara, lost 4 sons and 2 daughters, and he himself was, they've not been compensated for that. So have you also heard where these people, that these communities have been affected, have they been properly compensated or?
I mean, for the fact that it happened, you denied it first. And it takes conviction and evidence for you to accept it. It's even difficult for communities that are grieving to accept that you're sorry, right? That's one. In most instances, getting that apology is even difficult. But when it comes to all sorts of compensation, whether financial or non-financial compensation, I'm not sure I've had any, unless if these things are done not in the open, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I've had any, but most times I think, this is me thinking now, I think most times the subnationals are the ones that are doing those compensations, right? Mm-hmm. When it happens, you see the state government running in to do one thing or the other. But I'm not sure if the federal government through the Minister of Defense or the military have done anything. But probably the Minister of Humanitarian and Poverty Reduction may be doing something, you know? I mean, I'm not sure I know of a well-defined compensation, or if we have a well-defined compensation scheme on friendly fires and all those kind of things. I don't know.
You know, when they were designing the national security framework, and then they had that 4 layers of, you know, and they have the communication was one of them, to concerted communication. But then again, you can't trust sometimes when I read some of the communication from the militia, like you already said, transparency is very, very key. You don't get a sense of either there's downplaying of the casualty or even outright denial. But there's been in recent times another force that has been useful in that regard. We've had some investigative journalists or some kind of like that have been exposing that. We had the whistleblower kind of like this thing in general of that. How is that happening in terms of like, have they, because I know of a guy, is it David Hundey and everything, and then these people put their life at risk and face. How is that space? How is that space and
I mean,
role?
Investigative journalism, or more importantly, citizen-led journalism, that's what I should be saying here, which are anchored mostly on social media, have really played an important role, in fact. Because once it's out there, especially in the court of public opinion, it brings everybody back to reality. I mean, when we had that friendly fire in Kaduna that the military denied, I mean, it was a social media outpour and outcry that forced everybody to rethink and the government, the military to accept that, yes, it did happen, right? And you could see what is happening in Gaza, right? It's almost the same thing when Israel will first deny and then they will say they are investigating and then they will accept that it happened. I mean, it's nearly the same thing, right? But now remember that these are two different scenarios in terms of the actors that are involved, right? But ours is a complete different thing, right? So because that of Israel and Gaza, you might say, yes, could it be a sort of outright targeting, right? You could say that, but part of Nigeria has different layers, right? Are they really trying to target the community because they think the civilians are involved? No, that's not the issue here, right? That's not the issue here. I mean, I see it more from tactical and operational errors, right? But these tactical and operational errors are not standalones. There are other factors that have built that have built it to that level, or that are built around it. So to resolve them means to resolve those complicities and those complicities around why they keep happening. For an instance, if you know you're going to bomb a community, you feel you have Boko Haram or ISWAP or whatever bandit group operating in a particular place, and you know that there is a community there, nothing stops you from working informally to ask the people to vacate that community that you will be coming. There are ways and means of doing this, but you must first work out an acceptable and a plan that is deliverable and work with it. So for you to become very extendable on a lot of things, like the last one that happened, I remember one happening in the Southeast, right? Where to your own conviction, right? So you know the communities are not involved. I mean, you can again liken that of the Gaza, Israel Gaza, to the one of the Southeast, but I will not liken the one in the North.
It's not.
That of the life Southeast, you see that is almost like an outright revenge on a community. Right? Because most times you think they are the ones harboring those unknown gunmen, ESN, IPOB, or whatever. But that of not East, not West, are mostly tactical and operational error.
Yeah, I agree with you that I could agree with you that there are different layers to it. But then again, it also fits in into that military culture or that state, because the default response of the Nigerian state to any form of this is always violence. So you could talk about the Odi massacre, you're talking about the Southeast, you see where they went and raised the whole. Even in the Northeast, you're talking about during the state of emergency, there was collective punishment where you collectively punish the community for maybe you think they're harboring program members and that. But then again, I could agree that in these latest ones might not necessarily be within that framework. We could talk about the tactical operational errors. So if you're talking about that, the military has invested in, again, since Buhari, they invested in many of these like drones, this kind of stuff that can help with precision attacks. And now you say, how is that the gap between such training and upgrade to where we are? You know, what impact? Because I was in Abuja, they recently have this building where I think they have this, I've forgotten what the building is called now. It's a whole that's to do with is it cyber security and all these kind of like high level that kind of like get in these tactical skills. So would you say it's a case of getting this materials or this equipment without getting the transferable skills to deal or to use or apply these things?
I'm not saying it because I'm a Nigerian, but we remain one of the smartest species in the world. Mm-hmm. So our military guys are smart. So transferring those skills to them, for them, is a giver. They will learn it and they will do it well. I mean, there are a lot around it, right? So some may be even beyond what we're looking at. Mm. A situation where an operation has been planned and probably there's an order from above and is aborted at the time minute and then reapproved for it to happen. And within that period, there's a change of situation. And when it's not done, the people that it shouldn't have affected are affected, mm-hmm. right? So these are some of the things. These are some of the things. So again, like we agreed, you can't rule out the issue of corruption, where you're supposed to have this specification of drones that could do this and this, but when it's time to buy it on paper, this is what is ordered, but this is what is delivered. Right, so when you put all those things in perspective, we could see, okay, this operation is supposed to be done in the night. Do you have all the night goggle light specification that you require to operate in such difficult terrain? Right, so I mean it's just difficult to say that this is the only reason why it's happening.
I agree. Before we come to the last question, do you think the whether the bandits, whether the insurgents, do you think they've capitalized on this? Have they gained from these errors to maybe propaganda to increase their own recruits and all of that?
Of course, they know that we have. Political economy issues. They know that decisions in the country are determined by a lot of factors: culture, ethnicity, religion, and so on. They understand our political settlement thinking. They understand that this is a country where somebody will not take a decision because he's looking at his, how would this affect my political capital. They understand that. They understand that, right? So they're cashing on that as well. So that's why each time you're looking at national security, for national security to work, there are situation you or there are issues you need to say, I will rise above those considerations. I'll be fair to everybody. I'll be focused. If you don't rise above those things, you will keep being drawn by those things, right? So they understand our political economy. They understand that we have political sets of elites that have not sat down to gamble on security, to say, let's gamble on national security. Gambling here means less whether it's going to work or not, but this is the right approach, and we're going to take it collectively as a nation. They know we don't have that. They know that each time issues of national security is on the table, religion will play a role, culture will play a role, and all these considerations will play a role. And that's why each time people ask, oh, is this sabotage? Someone like me, I always like shake my head and say, it could be yes, it could be no, right? Because situation where somebody is saying, okay, this is a terrorist group, but the other one is not, right? This is a bandit group, but the other one is not. Oh, this is not a farmer herder conflict, but this one is, right? There are no standard indicators to say this is what these things are. This is what we are seeing, right? So they understand all those things.
Brilliant. Let's come to the last question. So I agree with you, should be. So let's now take it that you're the Minister of Defense, as you rightly said, and then you're the head of the National Security Advisor. What would you do in the short, medium to long term to deal with this issue? What would be your approach to complete?
I mean, first is, I'm somebody who believes in evidence, right? I believe in empirical evidence. I believe in co-creation. I will try to do a lot of co-creation with both military and the civil society, the state and the civil society. I will co-create groups, right? So I will lead this counterinsurgency. I will make counterinsurgency more of a civilian thinking, more of its civilian face, right? I will look at those things that the people really want to hear, that will draw the people to the state. That's where I'll be working on, right? Issues like poverty reduction, and I will work on local intelligence with those communities. So it becomes easier when you want to operate. It becomes easier to pass those information through them, and they will pull out so that those military operations can happen, right? And then I will create some kind of insurance that covers such operation if it happens, so that communities that are affected, monies can be drawn from there. I mean, there's a lot one can do. But these things should be out of the box thinking. If you go that direction, and then that should be sanction and reward. Every friendly fire should be properly investigated. Why did it happen? How could it have been prevented so that it doesn't happen again? These are the ways, right? However, it's important to know that once in a while it will happen. But the frequency and the number of casualties are things we need to work on to reduce them to the barest minimum.
Thank you very much, I really, really appreciate this deep and rich insight into the. But it's, and hopefully I'll support your candidacy if you put yourself forward. But I do agree with you. Our democracy is unfortunately very militarized. It's very, very militarized. But hopefully we'll get to a point where there will be a lot of civilian oversight over the military, and then we can have proper demarcation of what is the two institutional roles and stuff. But yes, I really, really appreciate you for this. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Ndubuisi Nwokolo, for his very rich and interesting perspective on the accidental military air strikes in Nigeria. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.